Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. You're at the gym, you've been working out really hard, and then you go in for the kill. One final push.
This is like the end of my workout. I'm gonna do a set of curls, as many as I can. Usually I'll get up to like 13.
This is Pulse reporter Jad Slayman. He's one of those people who actually looks forward to going to the gym.
The whole point is to run out of steam, to completely exhaust yourself.
That's about all I got. Done.
And at this point in his workout, Jad is sometimes overcome with a strong emotion.
It's like this weird sadness. It just kind of comes out of nowhere, and then it's gone.
And Jad, what happens when you feel this? Do you start crying?
No, I mean, that would be really embarrassing. But I do notice it, and I've just kind of wondered where it comes from.
You don't expect to feel sad at the gym, right? You should feel exhilarated, proud of yourself. But sadness can be really strange sometimes. It pops up seemingly out of nowhere, triggered by a song, a picture, a memory, a minor mishap. And there it is, sadness.
Sadness to me feels like a heaviness in your heart.
It can be fleeting, or it can flavor your whole day, everything you do.
Sadness for me is that I am alone in my thoughts.
All of a sudden, my heart is contracting. So it's getting bigger and smaller.
It's a feeling of emptiness.
Helplessness, despair,
the feeling of isolation.
My throat just closes up.
Sadness is in your mind, but you can feel it in your body, too. Researchers are getting a better handle on why we feel sad and how to measure it.
You can actually measure the muscles of the face to see if they sort of start forming a frown.
On this episode, we'll explore the anatomy of sadness. Why do we feel it? What is happening in our brains when we feel it? And what do we do with it? Okay, so we asked Jad Slayman to look deeper into this strange gym sadness that overcomes him after an intense workout. What's going on with that? Here's Jad.
So I Googled, you know, sad at gym out of nowhere, and turns out, yeah, it's a thing. I talked to Lisa Barrett. She's a psychologist and author of How Emotions Are Made.
Well, I can tell you what it feels like from a lay person's view. Like, if I take my science hat off.
She also happens to work out a lot. Her science hat is off for the moment.
Usually I'm aiming for an hour, 30 minutes of intensive exercise a day.
She does sprints and yoga, strength training. Recently, she tried this boxing CrossFit thing, and she's felt this gym sadness too.
Usually as I'm breathing myself back into a calmer state, I feel a surge of sentiment. I feel a very powerful wave of feeling. Sometimes it feels like sadness, sometimes it feels like gratitude or awe. Like it just rolls over me. And I do actually, I don't gush tears, but I do sometimes feel a little teary.
Her science hat is back on, and she says this weird emotion at the wrong time actually challenges older ideas about how emotion works. The classic view, she says, is we're all born with these circuits.
One for sadness, one for anger, one for fear, and so on.
So I see a snake or something, and my scared circuit lights up, and I feel scared. The body is supposed to respond whenever these circuits are tripped.
So for fear, it might be that your heart rate goes up, your heart starts to race. And for anger, it might be that your blood pressure goes up.
But she says research doesn't seem to back up this classical view. For one, these body changes seem pretty inconsistent. And if there are particular brain circuits for sad or lonely or angry, she says we haven't found them. It's more complicated than switching the sad circuit or the happy one. Lisa tells me to start by imagining my brain is in a box.
That's dark and silent, which is called your skull. It receives sensory changes from the world through your eyes and your ears and your nose. And it also receives sensory changes from your body. And it has to figure out what those changes mean. It has to figure out what those sensations were caused by.
She says we all have these four most basic types of sensations.
Feeling worked up, feeling calm, feeling pleasant, feeling unpleasant.
Unless you're some kind of Zen master, these feelings are basically always there.
What emotions are the brain's attempt to make sense of what the bodily sensations mean in a particular circumstance, in a particular situation, based on past experience, based on memory, using memory.
Your brain has to take memory, basically your experience, merge it with sensation, and use that to figure out what emotion to conjure. Take a single unpleasant sensation, for example. It can mean a bunch of different things.
So exactly the same ache in your stomach can be hunger, it can be anxiety, it can be longing, it can be disgust.
It's vague. So Lisa says the brain constructs emotion to kind of fill in the blanks, help you figure out what to do in response. Do you respond to that ache in your stomach by making a sandwich, or do you text your ex? And Lisa says all this happens predictively.
Your brain is always working predictively. It's trying to anticipate what's going to happen next so that it can prepare you to meet those needs before they arise.
So maybe at the gym on these last sets, I've got music going. All my brain can tell from its dark little lockbox is most of my body hurts for some reason and I'd rather it didn't. My brain has to make a snap decision. Is he sad right now? Is that what's going on? And things actually get more complicated when you drill down further, when you start talking neurotransmitters. They're the body's chemical messengers, things like serotonin, dopamine, adrenaline.
The role of neurotransmitters is really complex.
That's Laura Boxley. I asked her about these gym feelings as well. She's a neuropsychologist at The Ohio State University.
And they're often kind of stepping on each other's toes. Dopamine, serotonin, and norepinephrine playing important roles in mood, but then also in exercise, and then also in addiction or fight or flight. I mean, there's all these different actions where you can see different elements of neurotransmitters involved, sometimes together, sometimes on a spectrum.
For example, dopamine shows up in all kinds of places.
Dopamine plays a role in nausea, in mood, in psychosis, in lactation, in Parkinson's disease, in addiction. There are many common neurotransmitters that wear lots and lots of hats. The roles of neurotransmitters can also overlap.
Using a very limited set of neurotransmitters, the brain has to create the full spectrum of human experience.
It's more like a piano chord or some kind of dynamic where you have things that are feeding into each other into feedback loops over and over again across time.
So, like notes on a piano, musical chords. That is C major. It's a happy-sounding chord made of these three notes, C, E, and G. So let's take those same first two notes, C and E, but let's play them together with an A instead of that G. Now you get A minor, a kind of melancholy chord. Most of the ingredients are the same, but it sounds completely different in terms of mood. And again, in your brain, all this is happening constantly. Literally every conscious second, and using way more notes than a piano could produce.
And so it can be very challenging to say exactly what's causing what. But in reality, all these things are having this kind of mutual communication back and forth. It's not one direction, it's constant, and it's complex.
So if emotion is this imperfect thing, and if it's something we create instead of something that kind of happens to us, a circuit that gets tripped, what can we do with that?
I'm not saying you can just snap your fingers and then do a couple of, you know, Jedi mind tricks and then completely revolutionize your emotional life. That's just, you know, that would be awesome if that were true, but it's not really true.
That's Lisa again, the psychologist who exercises a lot.
And in fact, trying to change how your brain makes meaning in the moment is actually really hard.
Hard, But she says it's not impossible. There are whole therapies built around recognizing where your emotions come from, what thoughts precede what feelings, and how to take control of that. And a lot of meditative practices are built around this type of mindfulness. Laura, the Ohio State neuropsychologist, understands emotions better than most of us. But yeah, she still struggles with hers.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't have perfect control. Everybody's human.
But she says recognizing that emotions are imperfect, that they're not all powerful, that's useful.
We can kind of make a decision about, is this benefiting me or is this something that I'm terrorizing myself with? Is there another choice here?
So I guess next time I feel a weird sadness in the weight room, I can just recognize my brain makes mistakes here and there. And I'm probably getting a pretty good pump right now. For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.
We're talking about sadness. What we just heard in Jad's reporting is that sadness is your brain trying to interpret different inputs, what your body is feeling, what you're seeing, what you're hearing, and tapping into your memory base to make sense of it all. You mix all that together and voila, you have emotion and tears. Sometimes sadness happens because your brain is confused. But Laura Boxley, the neuropsychologist Jad interviewed, said there is an exercise class that seems to have perfected the path to tears and emotional release, Soul Cycle. It's a fancy spin class.
Soul Cycle has capitalized on emotion as a driver of performance and may push people in ways that elicit strong emotion using music, motivational instructors, and the group setting.
SoulCycle is a bit culty, I guess, but people swear by it.
My name is Molly Tavoletti.
Molly is a producer and photographer, and she loves SoulCycle.
It's the best. It's just the best.
Last night's class was number 544.
544 SoulCycle classes. And like clockwork, every time she feels strong emotions.
I cried last night. And it's like a very weird, it's weird.
Weird maybe, but it happens to many people. There's a lot of blogs out there that mention crying at SoulCycle. The music in class usually starts out chill, then it ratchets up, and eventually the tempo slows back down. The lights go out all the way, the instructor gets soothing.
Like, it's pitch black, that piano riff started, and she was just like, all right, let's go home. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm gonna start crying, here we go.
This is the part that keeps Molly coming back. It's a release for pent-up emotions.
And I think that we just bury a lot of shit. Or at least I do. I mean, you're bombarded by so much every day that, like, you have to put it somewhere. And I'll walk into that room not knowing that I'm carrying in a lot of stress or anxiety or sadness or anything. And then it just, like, pulls it out of you in a way that is, like, feels very healthy and good.
We're talking about sadness and the ingredients that can lead to us feeling that emotion. It's weird when sadness hits you seemingly out of nowhere, right? I've never cried at the gym, but I cry every time I go to a performance at my kid's school and all the little people line up and play the violin. I should be crying because it's so out of tune, but I'm crying because they're so earnest and so cute and sweet and pow, here I am reaching for my tissues. I ask people about this on Twitter. Tell me about stuff that makes you sad and weepy when you don't expect it. Here are some of the things we got back.
Hi, Maiken. This is Andrea Ford.
Andrea got weepy watching a TV commercial for a hotel chain every time she saw it.
It showed clips of people from all ages, all walks of life, all parts of the world embracing each other. And it was set to a cover of the Pat Benatar song, We Belong. I really don't know why, but every single time this ad came on, I would get emotional. There's a dog tackling his owner when he arrives home. There are little kids laughing with a grandpa. There's a room full of school kids hugging their teacher. These little moments happen every day, and there's nothing really that special about them. I don't know these people. They're not even real people, it's acting. But I think having these images of connection reflected back at you without warning triggers the emotion. I don't know if I ever stayed at that hotel chain, but whoever created that ad was probably a genius, since I still remember it years later.
I guess advertisers know exactly what will get us emotional. I watched that commercial on YouTube and I totally cried too. If you want to check it out, just Google Sheraton and We Belong and
Tell me if you cried. Here's another story we got.
Hi, my name is Jill Knapp. I've always anthropomorphized things, but for some reason, when I see a lost shopping cart that's far from its natural habitat, it just makes me really sad. I feel awful for this lonely cart who has no way to get back to its shopping cart friends. The worst is in the middle of winter when I see some poor shopping cart that's stuck upside down, that's been plowed into a giant frozen parking lot snow pile. Oof, it's rough. I might be getting a little emotional just thinking about it.
Thank you, Jill. And here's Xavier Lopez. He told us about a time when he was leaving his parents' apartment in Queens to get back to his new place in Philadelphia, where he had recently moved. So he says goodbye to his parents and to New York.
Get in my car, I hop on, you know, put on my classic rock station as always. And, you know, Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone comes on, and this is a song that I've been listening to since high school, and just, like, start singing along. Not really paying any mind to it, you know, it's like an upbeat song. I just get to shout a little bit, which I enjoy doing in my car. And just the lyrics got to me, and in that moment I just felt a little just fragile. And, you know, the chorus comes on, and I had forgotten about the chorus, and he just goes on and asks, you know, like, how does it feel to be on your own, like a complete unknown, like a Rolling Stone? And I just started bawling uncontrollably.
Crying in your car is fine, right? When you realize that Dylan was right, that you truly are on your own. Or crying at home or in the bathroom. We usually seek out solitude to let out the tears, but maybe that's a bad idea because tears are meant as social cues. That's what one of the researchers we talked to said. Here's neuroscientist Matt Sachs from Columbia University.
Theoretically, tears are designed to try to have other people empathize with you, have the group sort of come back and take care of you in a time where you might be particularly vulnerable in the social group. So what we see in the body and what we see in the brain are reflections of that. So we see that it's usually triggered by some sort of loss, perceived loss or actual loss. And then your bodily responses are all designed to have other members of the group take care of you as well during that perceived loss.
So we're supposed to cry in public. And it seems like New Yorkers have that part figured out. Public crying is part of urban life. Reporter Kathleen Horan has more.
When I moved here nearly 2 decades ago, I was surprised by how much New Yorkers do out in the open. Phone surfing, man spreading, eating folded pizza slices while walking and talking, making out, arguing, grooming ourselves, and of course, crying. I've always been sensitive, but resisted at first. If tears started flowing after a frustrating day at work or a wretched breakup, I attempted to shame the tears away. Leave your sunglasses on. Let's wrap this up. Crap, the sunglasses are fogging up. Okay, remove the eyewear, but let's get it together. Now I know better. No one seems to be fazed since they've been there. It often reminds me of a song I heard growing up called It's All Right to Cry. Shayna Feinberg is a lifelong New Yorker. Crying has been so much a part of the experience, she's made an illustrated map of the places she's shed tears.
I've definitely cried on the corner of 101st and West End, on 100th and West End, on the D train, the Q train, the 2-3. Definitely cried in cabs.
And she was raised by therapists and encouraged to feel her feelings.
In the end, like, I just was always very sensitive and always really processing my feelings. And being a New Yorker meant that I was constantly processing those feelings on the streets.
Shayna is a director who makes personal films documenting loss and the beautiful messiness of living here.
That's what a lot of the sort of local New York flavor is, being yourself loudly in public. It's been inspirational for me as a filmmaker.
The spot I've witnessed most residents lose their armor is on the subway. There's something about moving together underground and being neither here nor there, like a traveling purgatory that uncovers feelings. College student Julian Shapiro Barnum sat next to a fellow traveler a couple months ago on the 2 train.
I noticed pretty quickly into the ride that she was crying, not too hard, but like tears and some heaves. And so I asked her, what was going on because it felt like I was too close to her to not.
Since we all have so little space, city crying etiquette usually dictates that you observe someone's microbubble and ignore these moments, or look at them with kind eyes and then away.
We ended up having this like whole conversation, and she explained to me what was happening and that her brother, her older brother, had recently just joined a gang and that she was like really concerned for his life and had no idea how to talk to him. And I kind of just listened, and then I had to get off, and we shared this like really nice hug, and then I left and I was gone.
Julian says he was surprised by how quickly they connected and how much the experience lingered.
I felt like my sphere of awareness was so much broader. And I guess like my takeaway from that is that it's so easy to do something that means so much.
Psychologist James Susich has a private therapy practice in Brooklyn. He says with so many of us living in a tight space, it makes sense that we occasionally receive and offer comfort to one another.
My immediate thought is 9/11. I've worked with a number of folks who were first responders or who worked in the towers. And for sure, there were some who received tremendous aid and help and kindness. And yeah, that moment, that day just sticks out in my mind as an incredible, a traumatic event that actually brought out some of the best in people.
Connie Arroyo of Queens experienced another kind of tragedy when she received the news in a public waiting room that her husband of 50 years would never recover from his stroke.
Sam was gone, even though his body was there. And my reaction then was that I just let out a scream and I started to cry regardless of who was around me. I just couldn't care. The scream and the crying and the tears came out of my inner soul. And then this stranger, a black woman, came over and held me in her arms. And she just rocked me. And yet I'm a person that I don't like to be held or touched, except by my loved ones. But to have a stranger do that, it was absolutely wonderful. And she just held me until the sobbing stopped and I was in control of my emotions again. And I thank her wherever she is.
There's this reputation we have in New York of being hardened or jaded. But these fleeting moments of vulnerability and unbidden kindness keep me connected to this place.
That was Kathleen Horan reporting. Coming up, how do children experience sadness?
I feel sad because my grandpa died, and the reason I felt sad was because my mom felt sad.
That's next on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about sadness, why it hits us, and how we experience it. As adults, we can usually zoom out of feeling sad a little bit, like a commentator on a sports match. We can put the sadness into perspective, rate it, if you will, tell ourselves, this is not so bad, it's going to be okay. Or we can make fun of ourselves, like, look at you weeping at your desk over some stupid video. What about kids? How do they assess this emotion when it seems like even little things make them so sad?
I feel sad because once I ran into a chair.
When they get bug bites.
When we leave Hershey Park.
but sometimes children feel a deeper sadness that seems more existential in nature, sadness bigger than themselves. When do we begin to experience this emotion in a nuanced way? Reporter Steph Yin looked into that.
One of my earliest memories is of my maternal grandmother, my waipo, as I call her in Chinese, singing to me before naps. I was maybe 4 or 5, and there were a few sad songs she'd sing that would cause me to feel bottomless sorrow, a swell of emotion that would make me cry and cry and cry. And I had no idea how to articulate it or identify what was happening. Recently, I called my grandma to ask if she could sing for me again. Waipo.
Vinny! Hey!
成功了。成功了。你看不到我吧? 看不到,但是听得到. Here's her singing one of her songs.
老爷是水塘。I
was right, it is a sad song, an old communist song, told from the perspective of a daughter who's about to die. In it, the daughter is consoling her mother, asking to be buried by the lake, facing east to see the sunrise. It's tragic stuff. But at the time, the lyrics would have been beyond me. I wanted to figure out, why were these songs making me so sad? What does sadness really feel like in early childhood? Are kids just getting upset over silly things? Or can their sadness be more complex? So I started looking into the research. And it does seem like kids are acutely aware. They're sponges, basically from the very start, observing and piecing together everything, though we might think things are going above their heads. By just 3 to 6 months of age, babies respond to sad and woeful facial expressions. Infants with depressed parents or caretakers show differences in how they express themselves compared with other infants. By 18 months, kids take actions to comfort people in distress, and they show signs of understanding complex emotions. One study found that toddlers showed empathy to an adult who visibly expressed sadness and an adult who kept a stiff upper lip when a prized possession was taken away, suggesting they had the sophisticated understanding that someone could be sad but also stoic.
I don't like reading about violence. Basically, people using violence to do other things to other people.
You seem sad at breakfast too, and we were talking about...
No, no.
Parents don't know?
No. It's just that I'm sad because her dog died, and I really wanted to know it.
I talked to Lisa Horowitz, a pediatric psychologist and scientist at the National Institute of Mental Health. She thinks children experience a full range of emotions.
So they actually can feel emotions just like adults do.
That includes variations on sadness, melancholy, loneliness, emptiness. But children don't always process and name them as such. Instead, they often express their sadness differently. It doesn't necessarily look like crying. It could look like irritability, forgetfulness, not wanting to play as much, a drop in appetite or sleep, or really any change in behavior. Lisa says, as we get older, we adopt more balanced ways of processing and manifesting our emotions. Children, on the other hand,
they sometimes can even feel them more intensely because of different developmental trajectories. So hormones and their brains are developing. They don't have fully developed frontal lobes, for example.
Our frontal lobes help us to be in charge and in control of our behavior. So someone who doesn't have a fully formed frontal lobe might be more disinhibited, more reckless. That young frontal lobe plays a role in making it harder for small children to tolerate or sit with sadness, frustration, and angst. Then, Lisa says, there's the role of perspective or life experience. Young children don't have a lot of it, which can make it hard for them to zoom out and separate something little going wrong from something more serious. Sometimes not being able to find the right color crayon really does feel like the end of the world.
It just feels bad, right? And if you think about a 6-year-old, what kind of life experience does a 6-year-old versus a 30-year-old who knows, yeah, I've had a lot of ups and downs in my life, and the bad times, you know, they come, but there's also a lot of good times.
To learn about how to help kids better tap into resilience and cope with bad feelings, I visit a children's therapist in Philadelphia, Kim Wheeler Poitvien. We meet in her office, which has calming, dark navy blue walls. Kim often starts out with a book. She has ones for all different occasions: anxiety, grief, loss, feeling alienated or different from other kids.
This is my favorite one. There's a one that's called You've Got Dragons. Oh, here it is.
She picks something that she thinks a child will relate to.
And then most of the time it hits. And then the kids will be like, oh, that's me. They're like, I don't sleep at night. You know, my stomach hurts a lot. I worry about people a lot. I have these thoughts a lot of times. I'm scared. I'm sad.
And that opens up a conversation. Kim's goal is really to let kids know that feeling sadness, grief, pain, loneliness, these things are normal. It's okay to talk about them. And they'll pass. Sadness doesn't stay forever. Kim also works with parents and guardians. She says oftentimes, grown-ups minimize children's emotions.
So they don't really see a lot of value in, you know, kids' emotions. So they kind of put them as like very two-dimensional.
Or they'll try to talk a kid out of sadness. It's fine. You're okay. It's okay. Oh, look at that butterfly over there. But Kim says it's important for adults to get comfortable with unpleasant emotions and to not dismiss children's feelings, even if it's over something seemingly silly. Because those reactions send a message to kids.
Because if you're just saying, oh, you don't feel that way, you're not washing away their sadness. You're just making them know that you're not a trusted person that they can come to. You know, because more than anything, they want to protect you. Because they still have these feelings, but they don't want to come to you because you can't handle it.
Instead, parents and caregivers could acknowledge, share what they're feeling, and ask questions. Why do you feel that way? What do you want to do about it? Or go even deeper.
My name is Jana Moore Lone, and I am the director of the University of Washington Center for Philosophy for Children.
Yep, philosophy for kids. It's a whole international movement, and Jana's part of it.
To always change your desire.
But what about if you do get it?
If you have all your stuff, are you still gonna want more? Like, let's say I get an Xbox for Christmas. Then I want an iPad. Are you ever going to stop?
She visits classrooms and talks to children as young as kindergartners about the big questions that humans have pondered for thousands of years.
Why are we here? What makes something beautiful? Can you be happy and sad at the same time? What makes numbers real? Is life fair? Can you be lonely when you're not alone? Can you be lonely with other people, etc.? We tend to think of philosophy as too hard and esoteric and complex for children. But in fact, children are engaged in philosophical thinking all the time.
For example, one time, Jana was reading to her son, Will, a story by Arnold Lobel, who wrote the Frog and Toad series. The story raised the question, why do we dream?
And when we'd finished the story, Will, as I recall, asked something like, could we be in a dream right now? And that led us into a whole conversation about whether, in fact, we could be.
Her advice, when these topics come up, difficult ones, sad ones, existential ones, sit down and talk it out with your kid.
Listen for those moments where the child is asking a question that isn't looking for the kinds of adult explanations that we're so used to giving, but is asking a question that invites us in to be a kind of a co-inquirer with them. And I think that the more you listen for those and take advantage of those opportunities, the more those questions will arise.
After all my reporting, a few things were clear. Kids are deep. It's important to pay attention to their emotions, and we should explore with them. I thought back to my own childhood sadness with my grandma's songs. In retrospect, what I think was happening was I was picking up on the fact that my grandma was far away from home, surrounded by a culture different from what she knew and where she came from. I felt that distance, I think. And it made me intangibly, unconsolably sad.
That was Steph Yin reporting. There's this stereotype of the sort of tortured artist, the sad person who makes all these beautiful things. Is there any truth to this? Can sadness sometimes bolster creativity? Gisele Rigatao reports.
There's this author I love, Saeed Sarafizadeh. His writing is beautiful, it's intense, funny. He's written a collection of short stories and a memoir. In the memoir, called When Skateboards Will Be Free, he describes being raised by a single mom who was obsessed with communism.
I was in my bedroom playing with my toys when she entered and knelt beside me on the floor. "We will not be eating grapes or lettuce anymore," she said plainly. I put my toys down and looked up into her face. It seemed odd and outlandish, this sudden rule, the kind of rule that comes from nowhere, out of nowhere, made solely at the whim of the adult world. "That's a dumb rule," I said.
His mother explained to the 4-year-old Saeed that they had to stop eating grapes because workers were being mistreated.
As the days passed, however, and the boycott carried on, I found that my desire for grapes began to eclipse my compassion for the workers.
Saeed's writing has often made me laugh, but he says there's one feeling that has shaped him more than any other.
I don't want to say that I'm a sad person, but I certainly grew up and was inundated with sadness.
When Saeed was a baby, his father, who is from Iran, left the family. Saeed's mom suffered from depression, and politics always came first.
My mother neglected me. She would leave me home alone at night at a very young age to go to political meetings.
By his late teens, Saeed was very sad. He says that's why he started writing. And this emotion still pushes him to create. He's working on his third book right now, and a few months ago, he was stuck.
I felt miserable, and I was unhappy, and that lasted several days. And then when I went back to it, I'm not lying to you, bing! It came to me in such a flash, like it was like a moment of inspiration. And I went, yes, let's do this.
Experiencing this kind of motivation while feeling sad may seem strange. In fact, there's a lot of research that says it's positive emotions that enhance creativity.
But what we found was that very high arousal, negative mood can also be beneficial for creativity.
Modupi Akinola teaches at Columbia Business School. In one of her studies, subjects did a mock job interview and received either positive or negative feedback. Then they were given glitter and pieces of paper to create collages. After that, a group of artists judged those collages.
The main conclusion was that those who received negative feedback, they had the most creative collages.
She says that's because negative emotions, like feeling sad after receiving criticism during an interview, can change the way you think.
That can make you really precise, really focused. And there's some research showing that creativity can benefit from this focus. It allows you to think differently about different things and kind of put them together.
Modupi also considered biological differences. She collected saliva to measure a hormone known as DHEAS. People with low levels of this hormone are prone to depression and mood swings.
When you received this negative feedback, when you were socially rejected and you were low in DHEAS, which means that you were vulnerable to experiencing negative situations, that's when the collages were even more rated as even more creative.
Her research is in line with a study by Carol Jan Borowiecki from the University of Southern Denmark. Using a linguistic software, Carol analyzed 1,400 letters that three famous composers, Mozart, Beethoven, and Liszt, sent to lovers, family members, and friends. Carol then looked at how the feelings they expressed in their letters translated into compositions.
I do find this causal effect that negative emotions increase creativity. This is the main finding of the paper. And then in a second step, I disentangle negative emotions into anger, anxiety, and sadness. And the result seems to be the strongest for sadness.
He says the study shows there's a bright side to negative feelings.
I'm not saying we should make, creative people unhappy so that they become even more creative. All that this research shows is that these negative emotions, and in particular sadness, may be associated with something positive in some situations.
Writer Saeed Sarafizadeh had no idea about this research until I interviewed him. It made him somewhat happy.
It's funny because I feel like I've spent a long time trying to get over sadness. And now you're here telling me that that actually could be something that could be fruitful. That's a good way to end. Let's laugh about sadness.
That was Giselle Regatao reporting. You know how sometimes music makes you cry? This is Mozart's Lacrimosa, and it gets me every time. I think it's because it's so beautiful and grandiose and tragic, and of course, it makes you think about funerals. So why does this happen? How does music trigger sadness?
There's certain emotions and feelings that we get to music that we don't often experience in other modalities and other walks of life.
That's Matt Sachs. He is a neuroscientist at Columbia University, and he researches emotions that are triggered by music. Why we get the chills when we listen to some songs, or why we feel sad. What's happening in our brains? When you break it down, Matt says there are some key elements to a sad song that we recognize.
So typically that's things like slower tempos, more minor keys, smaller gaps between notes. And the interesting thing is that this appears to be somewhat universal. So if you play people music that they've never heard before, that's designed or written to be sad, most people can recognize that it's trying to convey sadness. But the tricky thing is, how do you actually make a person feel sad? And that's much, much thornier and much more difficult to do.
So it's one thing for me to be able to say, that's a sad song, and then yet another thing for me actually to feel the emotion and to maybe start crying.
Exactly, yes.
And are you doing this work to understand what makes a good sad song, or are you doing this work to understand sadness, or both?
Personally, I'm always interested in knowing what makes a good sad song. The research is really more focused on understanding human emotions. So the reason that I'm so interested in sad music is the evolutionary understanding of sadness is that it's something that we want to overcome. It's something that we want to avoid. It's something that helps us in certain situations, but that ultimately we're trying to work out. And so why is it that we're so attracted that throughout centuries, from Greek tragedies to current day pop music, there's this focus and inclination and desire to listen to sad pieces of music? It doesn't make sense from this evolutionary perspective of sadness, other than it must help us overcome sadness in some way to actually feel more sad. And so really, I want to know that. I want to understand what it is about sad music that helps us and what it is about sad music that tells us more about the fundamental mechanisms of emotions.
All right. So if I give you an embarrassing example from my own life. So imagine me as like a little teenage, you know, mess who has just like been dumped by some other teenage mess. And I'm sitting there and I'm listening to whatever, Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You. Maybe I'm listening to Sinead O'Connor. Nothing compares. Nothing compares to you. You know what I mean? So what am I doing here? And I'm just crying.
Right. So now we're getting into why are we listening to it? What are the reasons and motivations that people choose to seek out sad music? When you're in a sad situation, most likely it's this benefit of catharsis is probably the simplest term. It's this idea that you're resonating with the emotions of others, whether or not it's Sinead O'Connor's lyrics or Whitney Houston's lyrics, and that makes you feel better because either A, you're connecting with another person, you're feeling less alone in your feelings, or B, you're just sort of purging your negative emotions, allowing them to kind of fully be experienced and then be released.
So I'm going all in, basically.
I think the key to what makes sad music something that we so actively seek out is that it is vicarious in a way. When you listen to Whitney Houston or when you listen to Sinead O'Connor, you're not actually experiencing what they're going through. It's this way of kind of delving into a sad situation, gaining those cognitive and behavioral benefits without actually having to go through the social pain or the or whatever experience that they went through. And this is kind of the overarching theme that we see, is that the attraction to sad music has to do with the fact that it is in this sort of quote-unquote safer context.
I'm wondering if you have a song, a sad song, that you really like or that you relate to.
Most of them, I think, I associate with a period of my life. So they're very triggered to a time and very triggered to a certain memory. I know that when I was first in college, I moved to Boston. The winter was very cold, and there was an album that came out. It was For Emma Forever Ago by Bon Iver, and the song The Wolves. It's pretty much just a man and a guitar. The myth is that he wrote this album alone in the woods, so it kind of very much matched maybe not what I was actually experiencing, but what was something I was feeling at that time. I had, I think, had my first sort of brush with heartbreak at that moment. I had come home for the break, realizing that I had to go back at a certain point, and I listened to this album on repeat. Someday my pain, someday my pain will mark you, harness your blame, harness your blame, walk through with the wild wolves around. In the morning, I'll call you. It's a combination of the acoustics of the song, so it's a falsetto voice, this very high-pitched voice that kind of builds slowly, and with solo guitar, so it's very sparse, combined with the actual setting that I was in, so the fact that I had kind of gone through this more negative time, it was cold outside, and it just fits so perfectly together that I couldn't stop listening to it.
It also seems to really trigger our memory. There's something in these songs, whether you're sad or not, that taps into your memory, you know, and you immediately start thinking about a situation or a feeling or something that has happened in your life.
The thing about that that's so interesting to me is that I can have those even if I didn't experience the memory itself. There's a song by a band called The War on Drugs called Pain. It had just come out around the time that my grandmother was passing away, and it sounded to me a lot like Bruce Springsteen, who is my dad's favorite musician. And we listened to it together. Neither of us had listened to it much before, so we didn't have any memory associated with it, but both of us just started crying listening to it around the time when my grandmother was dying. And it was just purely because the sound itself reminded us of another sound, of another memory, even though we hadn't yet formed the memory associated with that song itself.
Matt Sachs is a neuroscientist at Columbia University, and he studies emotions that are triggered by music. I know it's hard looking in. No, not tomorrow, you'll be back again. Hang your head in, let me in. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.